Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few parts of this war that are more important and less understood than what the Chinese Communist Party is up to in general, but specifically techniques that it is using to subvert us from within. A man who actually worked in the belly of the beast for a time, first in Beijing and then in this country in Los Angeles, for Chinese influence operations masquerading as media outlets, notably as a video journalist for China Radio International and China Daily in Beijing, and subsequently for Global Times, both in Beijing and in Los Angeles, is our first guest. His name is Lance Crayon. We've spoken with him before about some of his experiences, but wanted to double back with him in light of a piece of legislation that's just been introduced in the United States Senate that I'd like to get his general thinking on and hopefully over time his contributions too. And we'll be talking about that in a moment. But first, let me say welcome. Lance, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to get your sort of 30,000-foot level setting right out of the box. How earnest is the Chinese Communist Party about using propaganda, disinformation, and, well, influence operations more generally, especially in the media, theirs and ours, to try to sap our will and confuse us about their intentions and otherwise advance their agenda of destroying this country?
I think that is their favorite tool, media. It's something they perfected, beginning really since, with Mao, before that really, and through Xi Jinping, obviously, something they perfected and use and rely on, I think, more than any other tool and or weapon that they have.
And you've served in some of those instruments that the Chinese run as journalism outlets. How sophisticated is what they do in promoting propaganda? As I recall from your previous visits with us, there was kind of a difference between how the Chinese themselves view these instruments and how they're generally perceived here in the United States and elsewhere around the world.
Yeah, it's a facade. They are in place to placate foreigners into thinking that, hey, China has freedom of the press. They have journalism in China. Really, state-run media functions to safeguard against journalism. It's there to prevent journalism from happening. The outlets that you see in America, the expansion worldwide outside of China, that has happened exponentially since 2012, are really just satellite offices for CPC propaganda. They're support networks, support stations that really have nothing in common with journalism as you and I understand it, but just promoting right in front of our face. They're not clandestine at all. They're right in front of you promoting the CPC agenda.
The Trump administration, to its credit, took steps to try to curb some of that, at a minimum, make them own up to the fact that their influence operations, that their, foreign agents of a, well, for that matter, hostile power. And yet, we still see them having considerable success in our own media. Let's talk a little bit about what that looks like and its impact as you see it.
Sure. As you mentioned, what Trump did a few years ago, he put a cap on the number of visas that Chinese journalists were allowed to have with only five different news organizations. The thing is, with the five that he targeted, they were the biggest ones. There's probably closer to, say, maybe 30. They're very small, off-the-radar organizations that employ Chinese nationals or, even better, Chinese Americans or Chinese with green cards, so they don't need to register. Okay, what the influence, the scary influence that the impact they've had in America, American journalism, are the advertising supplements that you see in some of the biggest newspapers in America, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times. Those advertising supplements by China Daily provide a lot of revenue, substantial amount of revenue for those newspapers. For example, I believe China Daily has spent, since 2016, they've spent over $20 million alone on their advertising supplements with U.S. newspapers. They pick the biggest newspapers. And you look at the headlines. This is how you can tell the impact and influence. Go back and look at an issue of the Washington Post from 2016 versus, say, one last week, and just scan the headlines. Anything about China, it's all positive. And it's scary. I did a scan yesterday.
You're not talking about the advertising supplements headlines. You're talking about the actual so-called journalism of the American papers. And it's not hard to figure out why. If they're putting millions of dollars into these companies, most of which are having a very difficult time staying in the black, if indeed they are in the black, that's a big deal. And you don't want to bite the hand that is feeding you, as they say, right?
It's a huge deal, and it's scary because China's going to move slowly like they always do. And they're going to start with money. So with their hand on the rug, they can pull it out from under the newspapers, like you just said. And newspapers would be forced to make further reductions. Newspapers have been laying off since 2006, so they would downsize even more. But while becoming or still reliant on money from Chinese state-run media just to stay afloat.
Right. Our guest is Lance Crayon, who formerly worked inside several of these Chinese propaganda operations and came over to the side of the light and is now very helpfully illuminating what these guys are up to. And Lance, I just want to say, we've got this new legislation. It's just been introduced. It's bipartisan. It is evidence of, I think, a growing robustness on both sides of the aisle, I'm happy to say, about what the Chinese are doing and why the United States needs to be pushing back. It's entitled the Strategic Competition Act of 2021, and we'll be drilling down more on it with you and others, I hope. But I gather that one of the elements that is seen as place we need to be competing better in is against this media onslaught and the influence operations that it purveys. You had some ideas about this. Talk a little bit about what you would recommend quickly, if you could, please.
As the bill states, part of it is to invest in combat disinformation. So my first recommendation is stop with the advertising immediately. Learn how to survive without it. That needs to happen today.
Eminently sensible step. One other that occurs to me is I think we should be challenging the ownership of publications. You mentioned the LA Times, the San Diego Union Tribune, I believe, was also in the hands of someone with pretty close ties to the Chinese Communist Party. We'll be talking more about that with you, Lance, in the days to come. We are out of time for the moment, but thank you for these insights, born of some very impressive experience behind enemy lines, as they say. We'll keep up the good work, and we'll talk with you soon. Next up, we will be speaking with David Horowitz, a man who knows a lot about what the enemies of freedom are up to in this country, the enemy within. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and welcome to our guest with whom I've not spoken in quite some time. His name is David Horowitz. He is a longtime member of the left who has become, in the past decade or two, a very important member of the right in our country. We've had our differences over the years. I'm very pleased to have him on, though, to talk about an important new book. He has written prolifically on the subject of what the left is up to, and I think this book is particularly trenchant and particularly well-timed. It's entitled The Enemies Within, and it talks about a totalitarian effort underway at the moment to take down our country, a topic we address a lot in this program, and we're very pleased to have him with us to do that today. David, welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Frank. Thanks for that introduction.
I wanted to just note that you have a passage that I find very compelling from Lincoln at the very outset of the book, in which you talk about, if destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of freemen, we must live through all time or die by suicide. There is evidence that we are in the process of committing national suicide at the moment, at the hands of the, well, totalitarian left. As a former red diaper baby yourself, you have, well, both seen and studied and practiced some of the tradecraft of the left. Talk a bit about how you see it manifesting itself at the moment, and who are its prime movers?
The Biden administration. Look, the subtitle of my book is How a Totalitarian Movement is Destroying America. That totalitarian movement was the left I came out of, which has spent the last 50 years infiltrating and, with the election of Barack Obama, taking over the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party is now run by people who hate America. The Democrat Party is an anti-American party, and it's a racist party, and the two are linked. Democrats, we refer to America as a white supremacist country, which is a monstrous lie. Just the absurdity of it. The richest ethnic group in America is not white people. The richest ethnic group are Indians like Kamala Harris, and the second richest, and it's by a good margin, like $10,000 annual income. And the second richest group are Japanese Americans. If America were a white supremacist country, how would that be possible? Black Americans are the richest, most privileged, freest blacks in the world, including all of Black Africa and the Black Caribbean. So we have this monstrous, I would call it a Hitlerian lie, that governs what the Democrat Party does. They have these programs, they call them equity. Equity means redistributing wealth from white people to everybody else. That's not equity. That's robbery. That's what it is.
It's communism,
and
basically.
It destroys our fundamental constitutional setup, which is that people are to be judged as individuals. The Constitution doesn't use the words black or white.
Yeah. In the book, though, you focus, I think, powerfully on the use being made by this totalitarian movement of race as a particularly insidious weapon for achieving the destruction of America. Talk about it, how identity politics is kind of the rubric within which it's being brandished, this weapon, and this idea of white privilege. I mean, you sort of touched on it there, but develop that a little further, if you would.
Well, here there's this myth of systemic racism. By almost the first thing Biden said, and he got it directly from Black Lives Matter, is that systemic racism touches every aspect of American life. A monstrous lie. There is no system. Well, there is systemic racism. It's called affirmative action, which got a pass from the Supreme Court and should be ended. But there is no systemic racism in America, because if there was, it would be illegal. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, passed by Republican majorities, outlaws institutional racism and systemic racism. So, for example, just take police departments, the main targets of the insurrectionary left. If police departments were systemically racist, there would be lawsuits up the yin-yang. There would be a tsunami of lawsuits. There are thousands of black attorneys, or black district attorneys, black attorneys general, black mayors, black city council members, black, I could just go on and on. Why aren't they filing lawsuits that police departments are violating the Civil Rights Act, because they aren't. We're living in a period of unbelievable lies. That's the other thing about Democrats. They lie every time they move their lips. I mean, Joe Biden can't construct a sentence without them.
It's not clear he can construct a sentence with or without a lie, to be honest, but it does seem as though there's a lot of lying going on. Let me ask you, though, David, because it seems as though something else that is violative of the law is the practice that I think reduced to its essence seems increasingly to look like reparations. But these are initiatives to reward black farmers and so on. Give us a flavor of how this is being done in a way that is calculated to inflame racial tensions, is it not?
Yeah, it's racial extortion, something Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton pioneered. It was rejected by the civil rights movement when it was raised back in the 60s. Because look, if you want to sue somebody for reparations for slavery, you need to sue the slave power, not the United States that freed the slaves. And this is another monster. You have even Republicans have been suckered into this, talking about America's original sin as slavery. Wasn't America's original sin. America was born with a declaration that all men are created equal and have a God-given right to liberty. The slave system was inherited from England, and we set out to end it from day one. By 1807, the northern states were free states, and the new territories, the Northwest Ordinance, they were free. They didn't engage in a civil war to liberate the slaves because they would have lost it. The South would have aligned with England and crushed the North. And, you know, who knows how much longer there would be slavery.
Yeah, this is not the history that is being taught these days, or the way critical race theory is promoting our past. This is obviously also part and parcel of the long march through the institutions with which you're very familiar. Give us just a quick précis of how that mechanism is being used to subvert everything from our education system to our culture, to the media, to our political life, to now corporations across this country.
Yeah, it's fascism is what it is. That's exactly what happened in Germany. The corporations in Germany linked up with the Nazi Party, and we actually had we're pretty far gone. What happened on January 6th, where a couple of hundred people got into the Capitol, which if they had been leftists, it would be a non-event. Linda Sarsour, raving anti-Semite, led demonstrations every day inside the Judiciary Committee hearings, confirmation hearing for Brett Kavanaugh. And their purpose was to obstruct it, and they were arrested. Nobody called it an insurrection. In fact, the Democrats on the committee called it an exercise of democracy. Well, free speech can be exercised outside the chambers. This was a deliberate attempt to obstruct what was going on. But on January 6th, first they said it was an armed insurrection. There were no arms. You don't have an insurrection without arms. And then everybody who died was a Trump supporter. And one woman, a 14-year Air Force veteran, Ashley Babbitt, was murdered. And Nancy Pelosi is still protecting, by a Capitol policeman, still protecting the murderer. Nancy Pelosi, I've begun to think of her as Nancy Pelosi, the way she behaves here. But the Democrat Party, if you look at it, it's been on a decades-long crusade to make... to undermine the electoral system. Paper ballots is just one aspect of it. Their war against voter IDs and to quell free speech. You can't have free speech if you demonize your opponent.
To say nothing of silencing them, canceling them, whatever you want to call it, restricting their ability to operate in the public square.
They will put conservatives in concentration camps if they're not stopped soon. You know, already they're holding all these people from January 6th without bail.
It is scandalous. David Horowitz, your insights into what's not only going on, but the impetus behind it, the ideological dimensions, and the purpose of destroying our country is incredibly important. We appreciate you sharing those insights with us. And again, this important new book, The Enemies Within, How a Totalitarian Movement is Destroying America. Come back to explore this with us further, if you would, in the near future. Thank you for your time today. Next up, Russ Ramsland on election integrity and more, straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Back, and it's a delight to say an old friend and very much admired colleague is in the house virtually. His name is Russ Ramsland. He has been active for several years now in connection with the work of an outfit he's a principal in called Allied Security Operations Group, based in Dallas, Texas, in trying to ferret out evidence of election irregularities that have, going back to the 2018 election, interfered with and, in fact, subverted the will of the voters. And he has been intimately involved both in the run-up to, during, and subsequent to the 2020 elections, trying to bring the skill sets to bear that he and his team have developed to try to restore election integrity. He was testifying about this subject in the Texas State Legislature yesterday, and we wanted to catch up with him and hear how that went, what Texas is likely to do to reform its electoral system, and threats to all of our elections going forward from the federal government's H.R. 1S1 legislation. Russ Ramsland, it's so good to have you back on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome, my friend.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure to get on the radio with you and elsewhere. So I appreciate it.
Good. Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk a little bit about your testimony yesterday. To whom did you present and what was the upshot?
Well, this was to a committee in the Texas House, and they're trying to look into the whole election integrity issue. Because that issue just isn't going to go away. There's something that was very wrong in the last set of elections. People know it. All the official, quote, denials don't seem to cover it. And in fact, in a lot of cases, they're simply labels, it would appear. There's no actual fact backing up all these, quote, denials of what went on. So
now that's interesting, Russ, because, of course, exactly the opposite is what we're constantly told, that there's no factual evidence for suggestions like, well, those you're making and I have been making, that there's abundant grounds for concern about the electoral integrity of, well, you started working on this in the 2018 cycle, as I recall. How do we square these two competing narratives?
Well, we really can't square the narratives until we actually get some transparency into the system. And it's interesting, for instance, in the new H.R. 1 legislation, they're all concerned about expanding voter rolls. And yet the fact of the matter are twofold. One, voter rolls are so expanded, it's unbelievable. We have fake voters everywhere. It's not expanding the rolls and the access that's the problem. It's cleaning them up. And the second problem is that we should be focusing on transparency. It would be a very simple process if real transparency were allowed into our voting system, wherein everyday people could actually have access to view the real paper ballots that are out there and to compare those with the machine reported results. It's not that hard a concept, but what is impossible today, or almost impossible, is to actually get access to either do forensic analysis on the machines or to do real paper ballot audits. And it's a huge problem.
If we were able to get that kind of access to the ballots, to the machines, is there any doubt in your mind, based on the forensic work you and ASOG, as it's called, have been doing now for years, that you would dispositively demonstrate that there has been not only election irregularities and you know, books that have been cooked with dead voters or improper voters for other reasons, and also downright fraud as well?
No, I don't think there's any doubt at all. The evidence is really overwhelming. It hasn't been allowed. Most of it is analytical and statistical based on outcomes. Everyone would love to actually get inside the machines. And, of course, that's exactly what we keep asking for. That's what so many people are asking for. People would like to be able to actually see a true hand recount of the ballots. Where those have taken place, we have already seen in many of these little counties that there are significant differences between what the machine said was in the box and what the paper ballots say are in the box. And we've got examples of that right here in Dallas, Texas, where we cannot match up the actual voters on the vote registers and the cast vote registers and the number of ballots. They simply don't match. So the question is, well, where is the truth lie? And only transparency will help solve that, but that's not the issue that seems to be focused on at the federal level.
Well, if, to the contrary, the effort is being made to keep these things as non-transparent as possible. But before we turn to the legislative situation, both at the state level and federal, Russ, just a quick aside. I was struck by the fact that a movie was released shortly before the 2020 elections called Kill Chain. A documentary film made by people who I think generally would be described as on the left, in which they actually did have access to some of these voting machines. They weren't, of course, at that point used in the 2020 cycle, but they were going to be, or machines like them were going to be. And the filmmakers, I think, made the point absolutely clearly that there were problems with these machines and they were subject to manipulation via the internet. And to some extent, they were designed for that purpose. How is it that this hasn't been more prominent in the arguments that are now clouding this issue, really, rather than making it more transparent?
Well, that is an interesting issue because 6 months ago, 8 months ago, it was a very bipartisan agreement that the electronic voting system was deeply flawed. But suddenly, with this election, it became simply a one-sided issue, and it's been ignored. But you're right. Kill Chain was an excellent movie. In fact, it was one of them that finally convinced us to go public with all the things we've been studying for the last 2 years, Frank. On the election system. It was done by Harry Hursty. We know Harry. We like Harry. Very smart guy. He's got a great team. And we have no argument with what they found in that movie. But suddenly it's like, well, that movie didn't exist. But you're right. Harry's probably a little on the left, but that's okay. Because the fact of the matter is, this is a bipartisan concern. We should all be concerned, no matter who wins.
Exactly right. And Russ, you know, in a similar way, the other point that you're making about the integrity of the ballots themselves has had in the past bipartisan, alarms sounded, notably by Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, who warned vociferously against this business of mail-in ballots, saying that it was a formula for fraud. So this brings me to the present moment. You've done forensic research into all of this. You've really wrung out the kinds of problems that have been material, Russ, not just, inconvenient or complicating, but actually affecting election outcomes. Going back to, I think, the race Pete Sessions had in Texas for Congress, and Matt Bevin had as the governor of Kentucky standing for re-election. But what we're watching now is the efforts that Texas, I'm sure in due course, if not already, certainly Georgia, are being subjected to as they seek to try to fix obvious problems with their election system that have made them, prone to electoral grand larceny, I call it, being subjected to the kind of intense criticism, not just from partisan politicians, but from, woke capitalists, I guess they're called, and not least Major League Baseball. What is afoot here in terms of trying to prevent these reforms from taking place? And can it be allowed, especially with the next shoe that's going to drop, which is to have the federal government say the states don't have any say on any of this?
Right, right. Well, it is almost amusing, if it weren't so serious, to see all these major corporations who suddenly pile on and Delta and American Airlines, I thought, were particularly interesting for criticizing the attempted Georgia new election laws because they wanted to have real ID. Well, okay, that's fine. If it's unimportant, then I assume we don't need an ID to get on an airplane, right? You know, it's ridiculous. They would never allow someone on an airplane. And yet the most sacred thing we have, our right to vote, and each of our votes should count equally with each other American. That's in many ways even more important than you're getting on an airplane, for sure. And yet these companies are there.
Yep. And Russ, as you say that, this is one of those issues on which the kind of bipartisanship to which you alluded is evident. The popular support for voter identification before you're allowed to cast a ballot is overwhelming and genuinely bipartisan, and it needs to be protected, not squelched, among other travesties that bills like H.R. 1 and S.1, now under consideration in the United States Senate, would involve. Thanks for what you're doing, my friend. Thanks you most especially for your testimony yesterday in Austin. I hope you were heard, and the state legislature there will act accordingly, and that it will be allowed to do so, because we will not see this federal statute enacted. Come back to us again with updates, if you would, soon. Russ, it's very good to talk with you. We'll look forward to the next chat soon.
We'll do it. Appreciate it. Thanks, Frank.
Next up, we're going to speak with Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, now Dean of Regent University.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a most special and heartfelt welcome to our next guest. She is a former public servant and now dean of a very important university. Her name is Michelle Bachmann. She served with great distinction in the United States Congress, representing the people of Minnesota, well, and all of us, particularly in her role as one of the leaders of the Tea Party movement there. She was, among other things, a member of the House Intelligence Committee. She brought to her work there an extraordinary background, though, in tax policy and practice as a postdoc educated tax attorney. She has recently become, I'm very pleased to say, the dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University. And in that capacity, as we talked with her about recently, she hosted an extraordinarily important program addressing some of the issues we just talked about with Russ Ramsland, the election integrity problem with the 2020 races. Michelle Bachmann, it is a delight to have you back. And I wanted to say again, thank you for this important program that you presented, which people can find at regent.edu/ election integrity. And I wanted to just ask you, in light of what has happened both during that program and since, what you're personally working on now to try to see if we can't get a measure of election integrity restored to our country and stave off efforts like H.R. 1, S1 that are now in the Congress that would, I'm afraid, permanently prevent that.
Frank, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be on with you. Well, there's both things that we're working on, just what you mentioned. First of all, we're looking forward. And by forward, we're looking at stopping the law to end all laws, which is H.R. 1, S1. This bill is currently sitting in the United States Senate. And if it is passed, it will ensure that there is forever one party rule by the Democrat Party. There will never again be any competitive elections. There'll be never again any way for your audience to hold the Democrat Party accountable for what it does in Congress. We're seeing almost a free-for-all today in Congress. And without that ability to have meaningful elections, and no one really thinks that we do, it leads to a demoralized population. So that's going forward. Going backward, we're looking at the 2020 election. We were all told, do not look at that election. Nothing was wrong here. There was no voter fraud. Everything was fine. But ask yourself this question. What if there was voter fraud? What does that mean? That's very important because we're looking at a presidential election in addition to very important Senate seats and House seats. If there was election fraud, that should be addressed. That's what we're looking at, and I'm trying to speak with some very smart people on what is really a case of first impression in the United States.
When you talk about the law to end all laws, I think you've got that exactly right. And people have to understand that if we cannot have the corrective available to us of voting people out of office who abuse their power or make wrong-headed decisions or otherwise violate the public trust, there is no break on what people can do. And as we were talking about earlier in the program with an old friend of yours and mine, David Horowitz, Michelle, the agenda of the people at the moment who are bringing us this effort to steal elections permanently is as radical as one can imagine. So it just makes absolutely imperative the work you're about, the forward-looking as well as the accountability for the past election cycle that brought such people to power, it seems, by hook and by crook.
Well, that's right. And I'm sorry to jump in on you. It is essentially a coup. That's what I believe happened. Because the dean of a graduate school of government, and the definition of a coup is a hostile, unlawful takeover of a legitimate government. I believe we saw that happen in this last election, and I don't think that we should sit around with our hands folded and act like it didn't happen, because as we see, it's like the store is being looted right now, and it's grand theft larceny of everything that has taken our entire lives and our parents' lives and previous generations' lives to build up this magnificent nation. So we can't just sit by. We need to take a look at it. And Frank, you and I were talking about the issue of what's happening economically in the United States. This is not a small issue. If I look, for instance, at my 90-year-old mother who has to live off of her fixed savings. So when you introduce this this untoward spending that's going on, all of a sudden the value of her dollar drops. She doesn't have enough money to pay for what she has. Her Social Security check all is rendered meaningless. Think of what that means to people across the country who gave their whole lives for this country. And then now at the end of their life, we have the most selfish, self-centered, greedy politicians that have ever occupied the White House and the Congress, stealing everything we have because they're willing low-level tools to bring about Marxism in the United States. That's what we're dealing with.
Oh, it is, exactly. Michelle, on Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic show earlier this week, you drilled down on one particular piece of this that I think has not gotten nearly the attention that it deserves. And you put it in very stark terms. You described it, what they're doing with these spending measures, this reckless theft of, as you put it, you know, our posterity. It's a war on the dollar. and a war on America is what you called it. Just explain that quickly and what the stakes are if we get this wrong.
I absolutely believe what the current administration is doing is they have declared war on us. They've declared war on the dollar, and they don't care. They're selfish, and they're living in the moment, because when you overspend to the level that they're overspending, to the $2 trillion here, $4 trillion here, another $2 trillion here. I mean, just think, just a couple of years ago, $2 trillion was the entire United States budget. And they're proposing this for like just, you know, an infrastructure bill that has nothing to do with infrastructure. What this means, when you overspend to that amount, you're printing money. It's your only option. And that money is fake. It's worthless. And so you're diluting the value of the dollar. So the Chinese have a digital currency that they're building up. Ours will effectively be worthless. There won't need to be any act of war with any bullets from China, because they're playing the long game right now. And their game is to take us down through the dollar. So the dollar is worth nothing. Ronald Reagan built us up with a strong dollar, with a strong economy. Now China is working through people like President Biden to bring us down with a worthless dollar.
Let me just ask a specific point on this. I agree with everything you've said. The Chinese goal, and as a former member of the Intelligence Committee, you're very familiar with what they're about, of taking us down could be enormously facilitated if the dollar ceases to be the reserve currency of the world. You say they've got an alternative cryptocurrency. They've proposed some others as well. How would that work, Michelle Bachmann, as a serious thinker on these fiscal policy matters, if we no longer can essentially float our debt and cover our inflation by offshoring it?
Well, people don't realize one thing that President Nixon did that was very smart. He tied the sale of oil globally to the dollar. In other words, people could only purchase oil in dollars, nothing else. So that became the world's reserve currency. In other words, it was the standard. So that meant that dollars were bid up. People needed dollars. Nations needed dollars in order to buy oil and buy other things. So the dollar was bid up. China recognizes the importance of that. They want to now be the world's reserve currency. As the United States dollar is worth less and less, it's less attractive to buyers. And also, we can't float debt anymore. That's the whole point. We can't print money that's worthless, and then no one is buying up our bonds. That's how we've been living, is off of people buying our debt, in particular China. So if nobody wants to buy this worthless currency because they know we could never in any universe pay it back, then we're done. Then the game's over.
So for all these reasons, Michelle Bachmann, I hope that your warnings are being heeded not only your old stomping grounds, Capitol Hill, but also in the executive branch. And I so appreciate that you are bringing your insights and your powerful voice to bear at Regent University now as the dean of the Robertson School. I hope you'll come back to us again with updates on both of these really vital issues. And thank you for your time today. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.